From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Ironically, almost one-third of food workers experience food insecurity and struggle to feed their families, all while putting in long hours to bring food to our tables. The Food Chain Workers Alliance was founded a decade ago to represent these workers, the people who plant, harvest, process, pack, transport, prepare, serve, and sell food. Joanne Lowe and Jose Oliva run the organization. It's headquartered in L.A. I'm so happy to have the two of you on, and congratulations on your James Beard Foundation Leadership Award.
Thank you so much. We're very honored.
Thank you.
I think it's important for the public to hear an organization like yours get this kind of validation because it brings the message out.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been many, many years in the making. One of the reasons that we started the Alliance was because there was a growing awareness about the food that we were eating and producing in this country, both in the context of the environmental impact of that food, as well as the impact on our bodies and our health. But there was very little attention paid to the over 21.5 million workers that toil day in and day out in the food system.
Does the Alliance act like a union where people sign up as individuals?
So we are a coalition of unions and worker centers that have food workers as their members. And so our work as the Alliance is to support the work that they're doing in organizing with workers and developing the leadership of workers and advocating for policies to improve their jobs and to improve their communities.
With so much in the news these days about how we're shedding jobs because of automation, are food jobs one of the last bastions of work that can only be done by humans?
Yeah, it's, you know, one of the reasons that Food Chain Workers Alliance has found footing and so much success in the last few years is because we see this growth in the food sector in terms of the economy. Obviously, it's the largest employer in the economy in the United States. And there are jobs that you can't easily mechanize, right? So, for instance, think of your last restaurant experience, right? You walked into that restaurant and there was a human being that greeted you. Someone sat you at the table. Someone waited on you. And there were human beings that cooked that food in the back, everyone from the chef to the line cooks to the prep cooks and so forth. Now imagine that experience with robots, right? Or imagine that experience without any human being interaction. What would that be like? And would the pleasure of being in that particular restaurant be the same? Now, of course, there's different sectors of the food system, right? So you can think of food production being, for instance, one of the sectors where mechanization could easily happen or happen more easily than in the restaurant industry or in the farm industry. But even there, the quality of the food that is being produced will suffer or would suffer if you don't have human inspectors, folks who are looking at the quality of the food that's being produced and so forth. So we do think that the food system is actually one of the last bastions that will survive this push towards more technology, more mechanization, and the labor force in general.
Let me just add, the number of jobs in the food system has been growing over the past decade. There is a trend, even in restaurants, on farms are trying to mechanize. And I know for decades, they've been trying to find a way for machines to harvest fruit and vegetables. But no one has been able to find a way that doesn't damage the produce.
Does buying locally grown food have an impact on labor, or are we too quick to assume that buying local or buying from our farmers' markets means good working conditions?
One of the campaigns that we are most heavily engaged in right now is called the Good Food Purchasing Policy, which was actually pioneered there in Los Angeles back in 2012 when a group of folks got together through the LA Food Policy Council and started thinking through what the best ways of addressing food system issues would be. And what they landed on was this policy that has five value categories that includes human health, environmental sustainability, animal welfare, labor, and local economies, right? So the local economies piece and the labor piece were not assumed to be the same thing because, in fact, they aren't. You could be a great local owner and still have pretty lousy working conditions and wages for your workers. And vice versa, you can be a major multinational corporation and treat workers pretty well. We think that in order to address all of the issues that are inherently wrong with our food system as it exists currently, that we have to go at it systemically and look at all five of those issues all at once. LA pioneered the policy. We just passed it here in Chicago at the Chicago Public Schools on June 30th, making Chicago the first city outside of California that has good food purchasing policy and affecting, you know, over $90 million worth of food every year in the city. And that, to us, is the kind of change that we like to see, that it's not just affecting the workforce or not just affecting the local economy or even environmental sustainability, but in fact that all of these things are so intricately interrelated that we actually need a policy that addresses all of them at once.
How did each of you become involved with issues of food justice and labor?
I first got interested in food issues from the environmental angle. In high school, I had a great art teacher who started an environmental club there. And in learning about different environmental issues and how food is raised and all the chemicals that go into production and the waste produced from animal production, I became a vegetarian. And then later I learned more about labor issues and became a labor organizer after college. So when I heard about the Food Chain Workers Alliance from a couple of the founders, I thought that is such a smart idea. It's very strategic to bring workers together all along the food chain to not only work on labor issues, but also to work on broader sustainability issues in the food system.
For me, the story is, it's more about my own personal experience in the workforce. So I'm a Guatemalan immigrant. I came here in 1985 with my parents. And my mom was a teacher back in Guatemala. But when she came here, the only job she could find was in the restaurant industry. And so she worked in the restaurant industry for many years, paid many of our bills with tips. And so for me to understand how for many immigrants, including my own mother, working in the food system and in the restaurant industry in particular was not just something that they were doing while they were in college or passing through, which I think is the impression that a lot of folks have about the industry, that in fact this was a livelihood and that it was a necessity for her to pay the bills for her family to work in the industry. That gave me a clear worm's eye view of what the food system looked like. And then growing up as an undocumented youth, I myself had to work in the restaurant industry just to be able to go to college because I couldn't apply for any Pell Grants or any of the other benefits that you get if you're a citizen or a resident of this country. And so I worked for every credit hour that I paid for with cash, literally from the tips that I got in the restaurant industry. And so that gave me a very, very personal view of what the industry looks like and what working conditions are, which of course is where most of the passion for me comes from in trying to change the food system and understanding that the food system cannot be changed without the people who work in it, without the folks who are actually day in and day out involved in the production of the food, the growing of the food, and all the way to the serving of the food in the restaurant industry.
Speaking of this long chain, is there ever a time where you gather together actual workers from throughout this long chain who get to interact with one another and feel the force of their numbers?
Yes, we have an annual Worker Leaders Summit every spring. We bring together workers and organizers from all our member organizations representing farm workers, workers in food production, distribution, retail, and food service. And it really is a powerful gathering because often these workers, they don't realize that they're part of this larger food system. And so at our summits, they meet workers in other sectors of the food system, and they share their stories, and they realize that they have a lot in common. They're often facing the similar problems in the workplace and in their communities. And then they also learn from each other how they're organizing, how they're taking on bad employers, how they're trying to advocate for better policies. For a lot of workers, it's very powerful. And we've had workers cry, and people definitely very inspired to continue to go back to their communities and continue organizing.
What are some other campaigns that you're working on besides the Good Food Purchasing Program?
A lot of the work that we do is in support of our member organizations. So we have 31 member organizations currently representing about 350,000 workers in the food system. And many of them have campaigns to improve working conditions and wages for their members. So, for instance, the Fair Food Program, which is a program and a campaign that's led by the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, is working on trying to approach Wendy's so that they could sign on to the Fair Food Program, which is a program that McDonald's and Burger King and Yum Brands and a ton of other fast food restaurants have already signed on to. But Wendy's is sort of a little bit behind the curve on this. So that's one campaign, for instance, that we work closely with. Another one of our members is Restaurant Opportunity Center United. They're working on a campaign called the One Fair Wage Campaign that's really looking at tipped wages and sort of the legacy of slavery that is still present today. For listeners that don't know, the tip minimum wage at the federal level is $2.13 an hour. It's been frozen at $2.13 an hour for approximately 25 years now. So the One Fair Wage campaign is looking at the historical reasons of that and trying to do away with the tip minimum wage, which, of course, you guys in California don't deal with because you have an equal minimum wage to the tip minimum wage. But in places like here in Illinois, the tip minimum wage is actually only half. It's only 50% of the regular minimum wage. So many workers, like my mom used to do, they would have to depend on the tips that they brought home. And in many cases, that meant dealing with customers that were sexually harassing them. In many cases, that meant going to work sick, because if you don't go to work, you don't get any tips. And so you don't earn enough money to pay the bills.
I've been talking with Joanne Lowe and Jose Oliva. They direct the Food Chain Workers Alliance, a coalition working to improve wages and working conditions across the food chain. Thank you, both of you, so very much.
Thank you for having us.
Next, we get a report from Slow Food Nations. The three-day conference devoted to food and food policy took place last weekend in Denver. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. The inspiring event, which is Slow Food Nations, took place in Denver, Colorado last weekend. Our contributor, Simran Sethi, spoke at the conference alongside such luminaries as Alice Waters, Carla Petrini, Ron Finley, and Alon Shaya. Hi, Simran. How are you?
Hi, Evan. I'm great. Thank you.
For listeners who may not know and may not even be familiar with Slow Food at all, what is Slow Food Nations?
So let me back up and tell you what is Slow Food. Slow Food is an organization that was started just over 30 years ago by Carlo Petrini, who is an Italian writer and activist. And he and his colleagues came together in response to news that a McDonald's was opening in Rome, in Italy, adjacent to the Spanish Steps. Petrini was a little bit horrified, and he decided that he and his colleagues would take a stand against the industrialization and homogenization of food by protesting this opening. But instead of holding picket signs, they actually handed out bowls of pasta. And they said it was a symbol of what they wanted to support, which was regional traditions, culinary heritage, and the kind of deliciousness that only comes from food that's made well and tended to carefully. We don't want fast food, they said. We want slow food. And from there, a movement was born that has spanned, oh gosh, not only 30 years, but has created about 1,500 local chapters of slow food that are called Convivia. And that includes about 150 chapters here in the United States that are housed under Slow Food USA. And it was Slow Food USA that launched Slow Food Nations this last weekend, which was the first event of its kind to celebrate the foundational tenets of slow food, which is clean, fair and good food. And this kind of happened through this extended weekend of block parties, farmers markets, workshops, cooking and tasting events, and book readings, plus a showcase of foods from what Slow Food calls the Arc of Taste.
So just for full disclosure, I should say that I was the founding leader of the LA Convivia of Slow Food. I led it for 8 years. And I really believe that the Slow Food movement did a lot to sort of jumpstart the food justice movement in this country.
That's a really interesting assessment, particularly because one of the challenges that Slow Food and a lot of the institutions here in the United States that are dedicated to food have faced is that they haven't done enough around food justice. And that was actually something I was really happy to experience at Slow Food Nations. It was a pretty diverse crowd, which isn't always the case. And there really was an emphasis on looking at justice, this component of slow food and I think of the food movement that has been overlooked sometimes when we're focused more on the food on the plate.
Yeah, I think when they first started, they had to bring us back to that traditional plate, which had become something so far removed. And then once we got into the plate, then we could focus on justice issues. So tell me about this past weekend in particular, who went?
Lots of people, all kinds of people were there. It was a mix of, you know, luminaries, as you mentioned earlier, people like Alon Shaya and Alice Waters and Ron Finley, who offered tremendous insights. And my gosh, I should say Carlo Petrini, the founder of Slow Food, also was here from Italy. But the people who inspired me most were folks that I maybe wasn't as familiar with. And that included speakers like Mohamed Dida, who's a pastoralist from Kenya, who spoke as part of a panel on indigenous food traditions from around the world, a multimedia artist named Bronte Velez, and her colleague Kyle Lemley, who's the community project manager at Friends of the Urban Forest, who talked about this amazing initiative that they've started to melt guns and turn the metal from those guns into shovels that are used to dig fruit orchards. And that was part of a session on food and healing from trauma. There were delegates from Slow Food chapters from all over the world. And then there was the general public. I mean, there were a lot of free events that were connected with Slow Food Nations. There was this Arc of Taste display. There were stalls that were showcasing treats from indigenous nations, states in the United States, and Slow Food chapters from all over the world that they call the Taste Marketplace. And then there were author talks, kids events, lots of block parties that were also open to everyone.
What is the Arc of Taste?
The Arc of Taste is a global catalog of over 3,500 heritage foods from more than 150 countries that are grown and produced in distinct regions all over the world. And they're kind of typified by the idea of small-scale production and place. Like at the Union Square's Farmers Market in downtown Denver, they showcased a number of products from the U.S. Arc of Taste, and that included like Bodega red potatoes, Mission olive oil from California, a variety of dried and fermented peppers that were both hot and sweet. And then these products that were made from the Bradford watermelon. Those were my favorites. They were brined pickles and molasses, which was a historic sweetener that hasn't been available since the 1880s. And that was entered into the Arc of Taste by a landscape architect and a farmer from South Carolina who has really been dedicated. His name is Nat Bradford, and he's been dedicated to maintaining the breed line of this heirloom watermelon. And this heirloom watermelon has been in his family for 170 years. You know, the reason efforts like this are so important, Evan, is because we have lost so much of this diversity and so many of the stories behind it. For example, there are, you know, 7,500 varieties of apples that are grown all over the world, but less than 100 of them are now grown commercially in the United States. And, you know, we know that only a fraction of those actually end up in grocery stores. So to see something like the Gravenstein apple and understand its history is really an amazing thing. It's been grown for over 350 years. It's like the quintessential old-timey apple. And, you know, participants at Slow Food Nations got a taste of not only those apples, but so many things that are part of this initiative.
Well, thank you so much, Simran.
Thank you, Evan.
And I just really want to encourage people to go onto the Slow Food Nations site, even though the event is over. There's so much you could learn by just scanning through who is there and what was being talked about.
Absolutely. And I also want to emphasize, like, to the point of justice, Carlo Petrini in the delegates event that happened before the kind of big Slow Food Nations event, he invited us, I should say, to consider the concentration of wealth in food. And he emphasized how when he started this movement 30 years ago, it was inconceivable. You know, he said, we were born fighting McDonald's, but today McDonald's is nothing. And when he first said that, like, members of the audience kind of chuckled, right? This idea like, we got it. We got one over. But what he was really trying to say is there is an even greater concentration of power in the food movement now, and we need to address this. In order to take our power back, we have to be inclusive. And he said that participatory democracy begins with participatory food production.
Find a link to the field report Simran Sethi filed for us about Slow Food Nations on our blog. Go to blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. Simran's a journalist and the host of a new podcast about chocolate called The Slow Melt. The last time Win Tran was in the studio, he was asking us to save his balls. The balls in question were the bright, green, crispy vegan tofu balls that he made at his illegal restaurant, Starry Kitchen, and now he makes at Button Mash in Echo Park. This time, Tran's here to talk about his new cookbook, Adventures in Starry Kitchen. His balls are intact.
That was really good. Thanks for having me back again, Evan.
It's my pleasure. You know, I've been talking to you a lot, I guess, over the last year, and I've known that you've been going through this saga of putting out this book. And it's so funny because it didn't occur to me that it would be a cookbook. I don't know why.
Why not?
I thought it would just be this crazy memoir, but the recipes are unbelievable.
Well, the recipes themselves are part of the memoir. They all have stories in them. They are part of our stories. So I take it as a compliment. I'm glad that you didn't expect it. So I want to give the unexpected.
So let's start with the recipe. As I was leafing through the book, I came upon the chicken wings in a pineapple inflected broth.
The pineapple beer chicken wings, yes.
Yeah.
Like anything Star Kitchen related, most of the stories are pretty simple. It's just something that T, my wife, our executive chef, our real talent, Star Kitchen, her mom created as a hot pot. And hot pot in Chinese or Asian culture is typically a broth that you dip like meats and vegetables in. And my wife started making it for me, and I was like, forget all that stuff you dip it in. I just love the broth itself because it has the chicken, the pineapple, and the beer. That is amazing. So I would skip all the dipping, which is, I know, the fun of hot pot, but I just made her do it a couple times for me. And then she made it for my family in Orange County. They're like, oh my God, we should have a whole Christmas revolve around the pineapple beer chicken wing soup. We did that. We made it for our friends. And that's how it evolved into a real dish that we put on the menu.
It has some really interesting ingredients.
When you say interesting, you might be referring to the fermented tofu.
Yes.
Which is really unique because it's like cheese curd, right? Like, you know, tofu, a lot of people don't know, is the coagulation of soybeans with some kind of coagulant. And in that case, a lot of times it's vinegar. And when you make that, you can get if it goes too far, it can ferment like anything. So you don't stop the process and you get fermented tofu, which again is like cheese curd. So it's like rich, creamy. And it has another layer of flavor that adds umami to anything that it comes across. And we marinate the chicken wings in that. So it brings out this really unique flavor in the chicken wings, but then it becomes part of the broth as well. And adds a layer of depth that you wouldn't be able to get without it. And then I call it, you know, the trifecta of flavor. It's the pineapple, the pear, the chicken wings, all things that go together individually, but should just be a superpower flavor together. I love it. I want to swim in it.
I think it actually might be the reason I finally break down and buy myself a jar of fermented tofu.
This stuff is amazing. It comes spicy, too. You get spicy fermented tofu. There's different qualities of fermented tofu as well. But again, think of it like cheese curd. Like, if ostensibly you can make your own poutine. You can make Evan, if you want to come back to the restaurant business, you can make a poutine out of tofu curd. And, you know, you don't have to give me any credit. You can just totally steal it.
Don't worry. I'm not going to do that. So I think of you as, on one hand, kind of this super outspoken wild guy. But on another level, I know that you grew up as a shy kid, an immigrant kid in Texas. Mm-hmm. Until you were about 18, you were resistant almost to the point of absolutely refusing to eat the food of your culture.
The experience, I mean, there's no one definitive experience that cements that, but, you know, part of it is trying not to be different. But the one that really sticks in my mind is going to one of my white friends' houses, which is something that I didn't get invited to do often. So I cherish that. I was like fifth grade. His name was Charlie. So definitely not Asian. I'm like, oh my God, I'm about to be accepted into white culture. And I remember one time sitting with Charlie and this other guy, Colby, who's still my friend and is still ignorant, but he's coming along. And he's like, do you guys, like when you eat rice, do you put your bowl up to your mouth? Because that's disgusting. And what am I going to say to that? I was just dumbfounded. I'm like, no. I don't do that, but that is how we eat rice. Like, I don't know even any other way to do it, but at that point in time, I didn't want to be different. And that is the crux of me rejecting my Asian heritage and Vietnamese heritage because I didn't want to be different. And by that point in time, I had already been made fun of enough as a kid for being Chinese, quote unquote, you know, even though I'm not Chinese and having to educate people I'm Vietnamese and being the Chinese kid and being different and, you know, I don't even think I wrote this in the book, but at that point in time, Wonder Woman was really popular. It was the Linda Carter version, and she used to spin to change into Wonder Woman. And when I got beat up, I would spin around like that too. And the kids would be like, what are you doing? It's like, I'm changing into Wonder Woman, and I'd get beat up more. So it's, you know, the hard part about digging into these kind of memories is it does release those emotions that come with them as well. And I just didn't know who I was. Was I American? Am I Asian? Am I Vietnamese? But I just didn't want to be different anymore. And it was really tough being on the outside looking in for so long in both my own culture and then at school and at home. Like, I just didn't know who I was.
And then what was the spark that made you sort of lower that barrier?
The pivotal moment I wrote in the book, and I'm using that at least as the crux of the argument, is when my parents finally took me to Vietnam when I was 18 years old. And I'd never traveled internationally. I'd been taught how to be Vietnamese and what I was supposed to do to be Vietnamese, but it didn't all make sense until I went to my country of origin. And the funny thing about this is that in parallel, one of my friends is Indian American, went to India at the same time, and we had the exact same experience to connect with the culture that we've been brought up to understand, to be part of, and be the extension of, yet we didn't understand completely. When I went to Vietnam and saw faces that were like me, and then saw all those machinations of my culture there right in front of me, and to see people appreciative of that and see how happy people were with a lot less, that made a lot of it come together and made me realize, and it was a long path and I'm still trying to figure this out, like how arrogant I was as an American kid who happened to be Vietnamese, that happened to have parents that escaped the Vietnam War at the end of the war to afford me a better life in Dallas, Texas. That is the crux of all that. And sitting at a shop house for my aunt and uncle's house and eating this caramelized clay pot catfish and pork belly, something I'd rejected all my life, and eating it and realizing how wonderful it was and how much of my life I'd lost and how much more I could gain by just starting now. It really overwhelmed me with flavor and, you know, memories and the things I missed out on and what I could expect in the future. I mean, it's hard to articulate in real emotions and real words, but it was really different just being a whole country of people that were like me.
Okay, now for a bit of a change. Tallow, beef fat, hardly anybody uses it. Why do you use it?
Because I'm Asian and we don't like to waste anything, number one. Number two, because it's delicious. Number three, as a restaurateur, you know, I remember hearing one time about Mario Batali and how he made, like, there was like a recipe that they, you know, his staff used to throw out like bones and bone marrow, and he saved the bone marrow and made it an expensive dish at one of his fancy restaurants, even though it was something everyone threw away. And it wasn't that the fact that he made money off of it, it was the fact that he was resourceful, right? And as a kid, I've been led to believe always that, you know, there are children that are less fortunate than me that would kill for what I have. And as a restaurateur, as you're seeing the money go out every orifice you can think of, you know, you want to retain that. And it's not to say that you want to make money off of that, but beef tallow is one of those things. Like, we would cut up beef ribeyes if we made this beef saute dish and we had all this fat. And I was like, we should just render it and do something with it. Like, what? Like, I don't know. And, you know, what happens from that is staff meals usually happen from that, right? The staff usually makes something. But the best thing about staff meals is it exposes dishes that you can put on the menu, because if your staff loves to eat it, loves to make it over and over again, they'll love to make it over and over again for other people, because it's probably just as good for other people too. And we made a sauteed mustard green dish out of that. You know, we've been on this journey to try to utilize flavors that are right in front of us. And that's what I try to figure out, too, is that I've learned from other friends that run, like, Chinese restaurants. Their main thing is, like, take five ingredients and make 100 different dishes out of that. And I was, at first, I was kind of stuck up about that. But now I'm like, wow, like, you can do so much more with it. And that's kind of where the beef tallow came from.
What's the deal with the balls out on every recipe?
That is a good question. I wish I set you up for that. So my editor at one point in time mentioned, you know, because I started an illegal underground restaurant, and part of this book is meant to be an illegal underground handbook, why wouldn't I give also the portions to run an illegal underground restaurant? So the balls out is the converse of what is in a normal cookbook. So the normal recipes serve like 4 to 6 people. The balls out recipes, or literally if you're going balls out and serving this recipe, are anywhere from 40 to 80 people.
Yeah.
And A, you want to throw a party, you have the recipe in front of you, you don't have to calculate it. B, you want to run an illegal underground restaurant, and you don't know where to start, you have the book, just do it and see what happens, invite us, and we won't tell anyone. And that's, you know, I'm trying to hand it over in a plate because we have all these calculations. That's part of it, too. Like, why wouldn't I want to give these to people? Like, this book is meant to be us on a plate in a book. You know, it's not meant to hide anything because I don't know why I would hide any of it. Like, it's enough pain for me to get to this point. I'd rather share it and see what other people do with it and maybe become better than us.
That's Nguyen Tran, the banana suit wearing, self-proclaimed chief instigating officer of Starry Kitchen. His most recent culinary adventure is Button Mash in Echo Park. And his new cookbook and memoir is Adventures in Starry Kitchen. It really is such a great book.
Thank you. I toiled over those recipes. My wife may have created them, but I had to rewrite all of them for the masses. And I spent about 4 to 8 hours per recipe because I realized that, you know, there is some demystifying of Asian food for people for some reason because they don't necessarily know it. And I wanted to make it easier. So when they opened it, they're like, you know what? This is not as hard as it could be. And they would try it. And I'm like, oh, my God, these flavors are amazing. And I'm hoping that people give it a shot.
So thank you very much, Nguyen Tran.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks for making me remember all my childhood past.
In a minute, we get the weekly restaurant review from our good pal, Jonathan Gold. Did we mention that this guy's got a Pulitzer Prize under his belt? Don't turn that dial.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Now it's time for the man who needs no introduction on this show, LA Times food critic Jonathan Gold. How are you today?
Fair to middling, yourself?
Very good. And we're going somewhere a bit unusual compared to your usual hangouts.
Yeah, we're going to Michael's restaurant in Santa Monica, which has been at the forefront of things in Los Angeles since 1979.
40 years is a pretty good run.
That's a long time for a restaurant.
It's a long time for a restaurant. And this reinvention with the latest chef seems like it was a significant one.
Yeah, I ran into an old friend today who I'd gone to Michael's with in 1991. And even then, we'd had like a really good lunch with the old Cabernet from the wine list. He had been talking about how the squab with raspberry vinegar and squab reduction was a real blast from the past. This was in 1991. The restaurant, because it's been so iconic, because it did create what we've come to know as California cuisine.
And exported it all over the country via the chefs who worked there when they were younger.
That first crew he had was just stunning, right? Ken Frank, who may be the best pure chef who's ever come out of Los Angeles, working in the Napa Valley now. Mark Peel, who started Campanile, of course, and was the first chef de cuisine at Spago. You had Jonathan Waxman, who's been a legend in cooking forever. And Billy Flug, who's one people kind of forget about, but he was a master of sort of American cooking, who just did great stuff in the 80s and early 90s.
And then later you had Sang Yoon.
Yeah, who's been doing okay at Father's Office.
And Luxion, yeah.
Yeah. And maybe it's unfair to the restaurant to keep, like, cooking it back, but when I used to go there, I always had the feeling that I was crashing somebody's garden party. The art in the garden was and is, like, just stunning, you know, Robert Graham sculptures and Stella's. And
it's one of the most incredible restaurant interiors and outdoor spaces ever.
They have better art in their men's room than most restaurants have in their entire place. But now it's much artier. There's a sort of almost like art school vibe to it, and servers wearing black and having asymmetric haircuts.
And the chef?
The chef we've talked about before is Miles Thompson, who was at Allumette.
In Echo Park.
Where he was doing sort of avant-garde takes on what was the small plates thing going on 5 years ago.
I understand that the menu is not huge.
Right.
So it's possible to explore a lot of the menu in one trip.
I went back 4 times. You were there for one of them.
Yeah, I was there for one.
If you look at it, the dishes seem to be the same, but the herbs and the specific, say, varieties of greens that cycle through tend to be different from week to week. So it does express the seasons pretty well. You're probably going to start with a buckwheat sourdough bread, which is almost puddingy in the center. It has a crisp crust. It's very heavy. It's sort of that Nordic-y thing. You always know you're in a certain kind of restaurant when that's the bread that comes out, which comes with soft butter that's been flavored with toasted barley. There are little nudie, little dumplings made out of ricotta that are served with a sausage made with lamb and nettles. So there's that little punch of bitterness to it. There's little shreds of Meyer lemon and some radish leaves. You have the salty, you have the sort of unctuous thing going on, and then you have the little punches of sourness, which I think is one of the things that Thompson likes to play with. There's a charred octopus with lime curd and sort of a shrimp paste vinaigrette. So you have a funkiness, you have the umami, you have the lime curd, which you would think you'd be eating in a tart instead of under charred fish. There's a dish that's been sort of controversial at the table every time I've gotten it, of summer squash, zucchini, and yellow squash chopped with some cherries, some cream that's been scented with rose geraniums and sprinkles of toasted grain. It could have been dessert if you'd ignored the fact that you were eating summer squash instead of peaches.
The food seems very ADD sometimes and effusive, I guess, visually effusive, but somehow it works there on that patio.
Yeah, it's of a piece with the place. The customers there seem about 20 years younger than they may have the last time I went in. And there are flowers on everything. One of the dishes I liked was, they call it chawanmushi, which is a savory Japanese egg custard. There was so much stuff in that chawanmushi, the crab, like pickled ginger spears, sesame seeds, a couple of sacks of uniro, in addition to the herbs and the flowers. In the first bite, you think there's too much going on, that there's a lot of flavors. They don't necessarily go together. There's playing between the ideas of chawanmushi and what a French person might do with like a sabayon in that situation. And the chawanmushi was slightly broken, slightly watery. I think you remarked on that when we had it that time, too. After your third or fourth bite,
doesn't matter.
It comes together.
Yeah.
It works. It's not a 3 Michelin star level. I mean, it's not even coming close. It's not playing yet on the same ball field as places like Madresa in Northern California, not even to mention, you know, French Laundry or no more. But at least he's trying.
And also, I don't know if I would want it to be that. I mean, there's something about the casualness of being able to just go there for a drink and a meal and be amid all that art and that beautiful patio. That's great the way it is.
Yeah, it's hard to tell because there's so much history there that you're sitting in that chair and you can't help it. You start thinking of like pasta with Chardonnay cream.
Well, thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you, Evan.
There you have it. Jonathan Gold Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times is eating at Michael's this week in Santa Monica. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations.
Hey, Evan, how's it going?
Hi. Matt Goulding is one of the founders of the food, travel, and culture journal, Roads and Kingdoms. His new book is Grape Olive Pig.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. And this book is just, it's just so much fun to page through. Last year, we talked to you about the book that you wrote about eating in Japan titled Rice, Noodle, Fish. Now we're traveling with you to Spain, where you say you're like an Iberian pig in search of fallen acorns.
That's right.
Tell us a bit about your original introduction to it and this way you have about sort of just focusing on people rather than the expected template of a food travel guidebook.
Right. So, I mean, this is volume two in what is sort of an ongoing series that we're doing with Roads and Kingdoms and Anthony Bourdain, who's our partner. You know, the idea of this series, both from Japan and Spain, was to sort of explain the world through the kitchen. What can we learn about a culture through the way that a country feeds itself, essentially? You know, in Japan, I was an outsider, transmitting that sensation of wonder that you feel when you first come to the country. And here in Spain, it's a different situation. I've got one foot in the country and one foot out. I mean, we're talking right now from Barcelona. My wife is from here. I had studied abroad here in 2002, and I'd done culinary school in the Basque Country, and I kind of wandered my way back here in 2010. And on my way to Italy, fell in love with the Catalan and never left. And so I've spent the last 6 years essentially collecting these stories of little outposts of food cultures from around the country because it's a wonderful regional food culture. And then the book is basically a compilation of those stories in an effort to understand and try to kind of paint a full picture of what it's like to live and eat in Spain today.
You say that José Andrés is one of your most trusted consilieres in matters of the stomach. He owns 21 restaurants here in the U.S. How did he guide you in the writing of your new book?
José and I came to Spain not long before I ended up moving here on a trip to go peel back the layers of the culture of jamón in the mountains above Salamanca. And from that moment on, he became both a close friend and a really trusted advisor. And we spent a lot of time over the years traveling through Spain. He's from Asturias, which is along the northern coast, a region known for their cider culture rather than their wine culture, and a lot of great seafood and a lot of great legume-based dishes and just really an incredible sort of overlooked culinary corner of the country. And so, you know, José and I have been there a few times over the years, and I was persistent enough to convince him to take me around Asturias for a week, which is a dangerous proposition if anyone who's ever seen or eaten or hung out with José Andrés would know. He's got a massive appetite for life in general. And so when you give him sort of carte blanche to take you around his native homeland, it's all kinds of interesting shenanigans ensue, and obviously quite a few remarkable meals along the way.
It's interesting because Asturias, I would say, isn't the part of the country that immediately comes to mind for a traveler. It looks so different than the Spain of most people's imagination.
That's exactly right. It's the Spain beyond the imagination. I mean, it's sort of rolling shamrock hills and misty coastlines and, you know, a Northern Ireland kind of feeling to it. And the heart of that food culture is found in the sidrerías, the cider-based sort of restaurants and bars where, it's basically a sacred institution there in Asturias where people gather. They pour cider from on high to sort of aerate the beverage as it comes down. They serve it with a lot of that coastline's phenomenal seafood. Really, you learn more about the history and the sort of social makeup of a region like Asturias through, you know, a few hours at a cider house than you would studying a history book or, you know, peeling back a layer of a museum or whatever it may be. That's sort of the general premise of the book, is sort of diving as deeply into the regional culture of every corner of this country.
So let's talk a little bit about the cider. Do they specialize in a certain variety of apple? Are they using wild apples?
There is an incredible amount of apple growth across the mountains and valleys and sort of hillsides of this incredible topography that Asturias has. And there's a ton of different varietals of apples that they use. It's the only region in Spain that doesn't have any consistent wine production and instead is taken over entirely by cider. It's lightly fermented. It's lightly alcoholic. It's 5 to 6%. And the most important aspect of it is the way that it's served, which is it's poured from on high as sort of nonchalantly as possible. The idea is that you sort of maximize this between the glass and the bottle that you're pouring it from, but also kind of look as casual as you possibly can while doing it, which is no easy trick, which is why when you walk into a cider house in Asturias, you smell immediately the sort of funk of fermentation that's stained across the floor.
Is the tradition of the seafood conservas huge in Asturias? Is that where a lot of the seafood that's in the cans comes from?
A bit of it comes from Asturias and a bit of it comes from Cantabria along the Atlantic coast, but the majority of it comes from Galicia, which is the northwest corner of Spain, the region that's synonymous with seafood quality, both fresh and canned. And so, you know, people are kind of always taken aback when they hear that there's a huge canned seafood culture in Spain, but conservas really is about the culture of preserving the very best of the small white clams, the razor clams or the mussels or the bluefin tuna, or any of the remarkable treasures that come from primarily the Atlantic coast, but as well as the Mediterranean. And then putting them into a can by hand, usually in these very small factories, and then filling them with the best high-quality olive oil you can and closing the top. And the amazing thing is that most of these products actually get better the longer they sit inside the can. You're paying for that. We're used to buying, you know, dollar cans of sardines as, you know, starving students in college. But in Spain, you could spend $50 on a small can of white clams without a problem.
Since we're talking about the sea, which of course surrounds Spain, talk to us about the Gonzalez sisters who hunt for gooseneck barnacles in Galicia.
Sure. I mean, I think Spain is a country that is abnormally predisposed to spending large chunks of their income on seafood, whether it's tiny baby eels that are really popular in the Basque Country, giant red shrimp along the coast of Catalonia. But really the king of all those expensive and rare foodstuffs from the sea are called percebes. They're gooseneck barnacles that grow really on the jagged rocks of the Atlantic coast, and in particular in Galicia. And so the job of what's called a percebero, because they're called percebes in Spanish, is to go along the coastline and collect these barnacles. And to get them, you have to sort of crowbar them off of these tough places where the convergence of the coastline and the sea is sort of at its most dramatic. It's a very dangerous job. And for that reason alone, they're very expensive. You know, during the Christmas season when seafood is sort of at its peak in terms of its market value, it can go for 200 euros a kilo. You know, so we're talking about some serious cash. The Gonzalez sisters come from a family, a long line of gooseneck barnacle gatherers or hunters. They're fourth or fifth generation. There's four sisters who all followed in the footsteps of their mom and father, who are both very famous barnacle hunters. And they've been doing it now for about 30 years. And they go out every day together, sort of face the elements. Along the way, they have actually risen to become the very, very top of the local associations of not just barnacle hunters, but as well as sort of the seafood and fishing associations in Galicia. And that sounds like a small thing, but it's not in the Spanish culture. It's really, in particular, it's a fisherman culture that's very masculine driven. And so these sisters have sort of defied cultural expectations to really rise to the top of a very insular world. Really what's happened over the years is as the Spanish economy has gone down, the number of poachers has gone up, which has both increased the danger of the job and has decreased the amount of money that people get for the seafood. So it's been a very, very interesting time, but it's really a pretty clear expression of not just historical or culinary factors here, but also economic ones.
So your wife is Spanish, and in Granada, you visit her 87-year-old great uncle, who is an Andalusian shepherd. It's got to be one of my favorite parts of the book. Why was it so important for you to share his story?
It's a story like none other that I've come across here in Spain. And knowing all the different Spaniards that I've met over the years here, it's still one that surprises and shocks even locals, because the background here is that in Andalusia, especially around Granada and Cordoba and these areas where the Moorish influence was very strong for 600-700 years in Spain, they left behind a culture of cave dwelling, essentially carving homes into the side of mountains that remain cool in the hot desert summer and they remain warm in the cold desert winter. And it makes perfect sense. But what people don't realize is that these communities, many of them are still really around and they thrived throughout much of the 20th century. Just so happens that my father-in-law was born in a cave, born and raised in a cave outside of Granada and in an area called Fuente Nueva, which, you know, at its peak had between 500 and 1,000 citizens in the mid-20th century. Slowly, those communities have sort of died off, but the remnants of them are still out there. And one of those remnants happens to be my wife Laura's great uncle, Chacho Ferrero, who's an old-time Spanish shepherd who, you know, worked his flock across the high plain deserts of this area for decades and decided that he never really wanted to leave this community. He's continued to live in a cave for his entire life, 87 years, has left for 9 months to serve in the Spanish military in Northern Africa. And when he was 19 years old, that was his one trip outside of the cave, essentially. Sharing that culture was important, one, because it's very personal and it's intimate and connected to my wife's family, but also because it's totally extraordinary. It's like nothing I've ever come across in my travels.
Matt Golding's new book is Grape Olive Pig. He's one of the founders of the food, travel, and culture journal Roads and Kingdoms. We close out the show at the farmer's market to find out what's in season in our neck of the woods. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. It's summertime. That means there's no shortage of great tasting produce at the market. Let's see what Laura Avery is shopping for this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're visiting with our longtime friends Dan Mattern and Roxana Julipad, who have been coming to the market for years, and they're very excited. We're all excited that they've opened another new restaurant, Friends and Family. Roxana Julipad is baker owner. Dan Mattern is chef owner of Friends and Family, located in basically Thai Town. What are you guys shopping for today?
Basically everything, because we do all our shopping here at the farmer's market. Lots of great things happening with summer squash and shelling beans. You know, melons are now making an appearance.
When you say shelling beans, tell me what those are.
Beans that are grown for, I guess, the actual bean inside the pod. So things like cranberry beans, tongue of fire beans. I would even throw garbanzo beans into that category.
And that's a summer dish?
Yes, that's a summer dish we're working on now. We use them a lot in soups with lots of zucchini and fresh beans. You really get just like a nice creamy texture from them.
So what's a dish that you're creating that you're thinking of right now?
Well, we're doing a few things along that line. One is like the fresh soup I was talking about with just really quick cook of diced zucchini with some shelling beans, a little bit of onion, and quick fresh tomato at the end with a handful of basil for like a really light supper on a summer day. We're also slow cooking a bunch of squash to do in frittata meats tortilla that we serve at room temperature from our little deli we have set up over there.
What kind of herbs like to go with summer squash?
Basil is definitely a fan. Summer savory is something I like to do with squash a lot.
So Dan, you know, it's been so hot. Can you suggest some cool summer dishes using zucchini?
Roxana and I took a trip to Turkey a couple years ago, and one of the things we ate there, which was just so simple but so amazing, was a zucchini and yogurt dip. And really what that involves is just grating some zucchini, squeezing the water out of it, and then throwing it in a pan with a little olive oil and just cook it just enough till it takes off that raw edge. Just cool it down and stir in like some really nice thick yogurt with some chopped walnuts, tiny bit of garlic just to give it a little bite, and a little fresh green onion, and just a couple pinches of salt. And that's a great sort of little lunch or a little snack you can dip a little fresh bread into.
So nothing goes in a blender. You just throw it in there and stir it around.
We just throw it in and stir it around. You could definitely blend it if you wanted that smooth texture. But generally, you know, in the kitchen, we're always looking to balance textures. You know, you want to have like a little crunch along with the little creaminess. And this dish really fits the bill.
Sounds fabulous. That was Dan Mattern. He is chef owner at Friends and Family. And Roxana Julepat, his cooking partner, is the baker owner and longtime shoppers here. And so glad that they're back with another restaurant. I'm talking now with Mark Carpenter, whose farm, Coastal Farm, located in Santa Paula, grows a lot of the zucchini that Dan was talking about. And we wandered on over here, Mark, and we looked at your table, and we see all different kinds of what I guess I would call summer squash, the round ones, the flat ones, the curvy ones. Can you tell us what kind of squashes you grow and what the season is?
Sure. We grow about 8 different varieties, maybe 8 or 10. We start planting it pretty early, maybe after any chance of frost is gone, we start planting. And we kind of keep planting it so we can carry it on through the fall.
What makes it stop? Is it the weather just gets too cold?
Yeah, once it cools off, it really doesn't produce that well. And people are kind of ready for a change after summer, too. They don't really want to keep on eating summer squash in the fall and winter.
But I think that summer squash is one of the most versatile, sturdy, reliable vegetables there is. And Dan was talking about the 6 to 8 inch long, you know, green zucchini that he likes simply because it's easy to deal with. But can you talk about like this flat flying saucer shaped one? What's that?
Yeah, I can. This variety is called Patty Green Tint. We also grow a yellow variety called Sunburst. Funny you say that because this is actually my favorite variety. It's super dense. And it gets kind of creamy when you cook it. I really like that about it. The problem with it is it scuffs and scratches very easily, so it's kind of a hard sell sometimes if you don't pick it just right.
And a lot of the summer squash, you don't even need to peel. In fact, I think you don't need to peel any of it when you cook it, do you?
I have never peeled it. No, the skin is so thin. You just eat the whole thing. And like you said, it's super versatile. We make like a cream of zucchini soup that's so easy to make with just potatoes and onions and zucchini, and then you just kind of blend it all together with some chicken stock, some basil at the very end. You just blend it all together. It's so easy.
Now, the round little, I don't know, they're called 8 balls, or what are those little round guys?
Yeah, you know, there's 8 ball, and then there's a lighter variety. It's called Rondinis, which is an old French variety. And then there's a yellow one they call, I think, 1 ball. Mm-hmm. I like the 8 ball on the grill when you slice it, kind of like half-inch thick slices. And
do they call that a 1 ball because all the yellow pool balls are number one?
Yes, that's right.
Cool. I know squash plants tend to spread all over the place. You must have quite a bit of land dedicated to growing these.
We do half-acre blocks, and some of the varieties sprawl, like some of the crooknecks sprawl, and others are just like an upright bush, and they don't sprawl at all. Some people use transplants to plant it, which we just direct seed the seed right in the ground, and if the weather's right, a week later, you have a squash popping out of the ground.
Yeah, I think it's one of the easiest things for the backyard gardener to grow. I think they produce vegetables in like 45 days.
That's correct. Yeah, yeah. As soon as you see the flower, you know you got squash coming.
That was Mark Carpenter. His farm is called Coastal Farm. He's from Santa Paula, and he comes to the Wednesday and Saturday Santa Monica farmers markets. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
That's it for this week's show. As always, if you missed any part of it, you have plenty of opportunity to listen to the show on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Of course, you can also download our show wherever you get your podcasts. As always, so many thanks to the Good Food team. Here they are.
Abby Fentress-Swanson.
Laurel Garcia.
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine.
Camellia Say.
Joel Stein.
And Ronnie Mickelson.
And I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll be back next week with more good food.